Hello everyone, welcome to the Cultural Intelligence podcast by RWS. Today we're going to talk about how life sciences teams can apply AI in linguistic validation processes. To answer all our questions today, we are welcoming Dan Herring, Global VP of Digital Health, and we're going to cover why AI is uniquely complex in the life sciences domain. We're going to talk about green zones vs red zones. And finally, we're going to talk about how life sciences teams can modernize linguistic validation workflows and processes. Can't wait for you to watch it. It's a great episode. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Cultural Intelligence podcast series by RWS. Today, we're welcoming Dan Herring. Thank you for coming here. Very, very pleased to have you. Dan, do you want to give a short introduction? What do you do for RWS? What is your title? What is it? You know, what do you do on your day on a daily basis?
Yeah, absolutely. My name's Dan Herring. I am the Global Vice President of Digital Health. Been with RWS now for 3 years. Been in the industry for close to 19 years now. I'm based in the UK. My accent does throw it off. I'm originally American, but moved over to the UK 9 years ago. And before that, lived in China for 3 years. So I'm kind of a global citizen of the world, but now the UK is my permanent home, but have always been in the life science area. Grew up as kind of the nerdy biology kid and somehow fell into the world of linguistics. And my team here focuses primarily on linguistic validation projects as well as rater training projects. So this is, you know, materials that are being developed by copyright holders to administer questionnaires or instruments to a patient during a clinical study. And then in addition to that, on the rater training side, this is actually taking those questionnaires and training the clinicians who are going to be administering to those patients to ensure that they are actually, conveying the right message to the individuals that are taking part of the trials. So my role here kind of versus a lot of different areas from, you know, the questionnaires to eCOA. So this is where we do a lot of the electronic capturing of paper, but in a digital format. So to have more streamlined, you know, feedback during a trial that you can easily see rather than, you know, relying on a paper document trail. And then the final side is the rater training, which is more the compliance, the understanding, and to really ensure setting up a clinical site that the individuals are providing the right adequate training on how to administer the questionnaire.
Maybe a good introduction would be to explain why life sciences is such a complex environment to deploy AI. Do you want to say something about that?
Yeah, so I think a lot of life science companies, they're not scared of AI. They just don't know how to use it properly yet. So when you think about pharmaceutical industry, they're dealing with a lot of clinical endpoints, patient materials. So it has to go through a very robust translation process to ensure the linguistic as well as the cultural, you know, meaning resonates to that audience. And it's very hard to take, you know, English content sometime and have that resonate into 47 different, you know, locales. So I think, you know, life science companies aren't scared of AI. They're just trying to figure out what is the best ways of using it, but also showing the documentation that is needed when you are submitting to the health authorities. How was translated? How was it understood by the patients? Because if you think about it, a lot of the translation, especially for linguistic validation, is around patient data experience. So it's ensuring that, you know, taking this medication is giving them a better quality of life. So when you are filling out these questionnaires from a patient standpoint, you know, US-centric questions sometimes could be very difficult to be understood in another culture because it's not either relevant because, you know, some questionnaires will have things like, you know, cilantro as an example, part of the question. But in Japan, not many people know what cilantro is. So this is where we come in and really ensure that the English is being translated not only appropriate for the region, but also the nuances that goes on with the countries.
And I guess, like in many countries, even the apps you use for, you know, to keep track of your health or whatever are different. We don't have like, you know, we don't have like one system for the whole world. So you kind of need to put yourself in the shoes of the person using it more than in any other industries, really. Like it's very, you have a lot of different criteria to take into consideration.
Oh, absolutely. And especially, you know, when patients are enrolling in clinical studies, a lot has moved into more of a DCT, which is decentralized clinical trials, to give better access to patients rather than them coming to the sites to complete questionnaires or fill out information or, you know, to be seen. They could do it now virtually. So ensuring that their platforms that they are, you know, supplying their responses is understandable, easy to use, has really good flexibility when it comes to how they can, you know, update their, you know, food diary. Having that rather than writing it down, because we all know if you intend to do something, writing down, you may not get to it. But when you have it on your cell phone, which is basically glued to all of our hips today, they can easily fill out the information and really ensure that the technology is being their friend, minus kind of being a kind of a inhibitor from what they're trying to do.
What would you say would be the main considerations you have to take into account before wanting to deploy AI? Like what top list of what you need to have in mind?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is when you are planning to use AI, and you know, AI is still very new, they still need to make sure that things are documented appropriately, how the AI was set up, the decisions that are making, because you know, when I look at AI, it looks very clever, but you also need to make sure how was it trained to make sure there's no bias or anything along those lines, because AI is only as good as what you train it to do. So, you know, when it comes to pharma companies that want to actually deploy AI, you know, around translations for either, you know, their ICFs or for their clinical outcome assessments, it's very difficult because some of them can definitely be used by using machine translation and then have a post editor just to ensure that there's no inconsistencies. But then when you look at clinical outcome assessments, and this is where linguistic validation comes in, we're bound by regulations to go through this translation process. So we can't say, oh, we want to try AI for this. You need to actually go into a very in-depth pilot and document, this is what we want to do, because regulations have not changed in 20 years. We have to follow the FDA PRO guidance. We have to follow, you know, ISOCAL and ISPOR best practices. So, you know, for us, we're actually encouraging sponsors to move in to doing a pilot to focus on the harmonization process. Because if you think about it, if you're able to save 5-10 days in the translations, that's really massive for a clinical study. So when we look at the actual translations itself, AI with a post editor will get you the quality that you need to get to while making it still faster. But when it comes to that, you need to make sure that you document, this is the process that we had. We still had, you know, human elements into the process, not just trusting AI to be able to do an output. And this is where we can really kind of change things. So having that kind of contain pilot and then showing the health authorities at submission, yes, this is a different way of approaching what we have always done, but we saw 2 week savings. It did not change the meeting. And this is as equivalent to human translations if it was done from scratch.
Okay. Yeah. I have a question, I think, that links a bit to that, but I have another one first, so we can come back to that
later.
Go ahead. what would you say future states linguistic validation workflow looks like then when AI is used responsibly?
So, you know, just focusing on linguistic validation, it's the industry has kind of been set up kind of Frankenstein. And I use that kindly just because we had to follow a very robust process that went into place back in 2005. Mm-hmm. And I think at the time and over the course of the creation of this, all vendors got stuck in a way saying, we have to do it this way. Technology is not our friend. Yeah. We can't use, you know, translation memories. We can't do this. And I think we all just felt holden to this process, even though the interpretation that we originally had is not true. You know, everyone is encouraging technology. And this is where we have stepped in, you know, at RWS about a year ago to really start being more tech-led. This is not meaning we are going to be using machine translation on the translations or anything along those lines, but having a platform where you can actually set up a workflow and be able to really kind of streamline the process. Because if you look at a linguistic validation project, there's about 40 handoffs. And that is because you have dual forward translations, you have back translation, reconciliation, comparative reviews. And then depending on the clinical endpoint that's going to be used, you either have to go through a clinician review or cognitive briefing. And when you include cognitive briefing, now you have a debriefer enrolling 5 patients within the disease state and asking them the questionnaires. And this is why, you know, when people look at these documents, sometimes they're about 800 words, 3 pages long, but they are very high expensive price tag projects just because you have so many people involved in a process to ensure that it's being linguistically validated correctly, ensure that the patient experience and understanding is done, you know, understood by everyone who's filling out the paperwork.
And would you say that sometimes people are a bit more scared about AI than, you know, everyone talks about AI and everyone talks about the benefits of AI? Would you say that sometimes people are also, on the contrary, a bit more scared of it than they should be? You know, if you have some use cases where it actually turned out perfectly and people were a bit scared to start with, but in the end, maybe there are some spots where you don't have to be that scared, you know?
So my biggest standpoint on AI, it's very clever. I think it does help. It's not perfect. There's many times where I'll use an AI agent like ChatGPT or Gemini, and I will get a hallucination. I'm like, well, that doesn't look right. But I think AI is very helpful in certain areas, and I think it's going to improve over time. But, you know, if you need to check an email to, you know, just edit it just to ensure that, hey, I got all my grammar correctly, it's been great use case. And then, you know, when it comes to practical work on our side, you know, there are a lot of areas of very heavily managed project management hours associated with these projects. We are using AI to be able to help support that. So after doing cognitive briefing, when we have to create the report, we'll use AI to, you know, use the transcripts to help writing the actual report itself, but then have a human go in and then to make the necessary updates that is needed. So that's a huge savings. Makes it quicker, makes it easier. But like the biggest theme is AI is your friend, but the human in the loop element is really the most helpful just to ensure, you know, there's no hallucinations, everything is going well, and to make it much more efficient. I think the efficiency, I have noticed I have more time in my day, especially when it comes to emails, because I'll write the draft, throw it in, and have it do a double check just to make sure I sound, or, you know, even ask it, make me sound more professional or friendlier. It helps to take out some of the thoughts, but it's still my information is just being edited.
Yeah. I guess that's like general benefits. Do you have a couple of examples of what life sciences teams can also expect in terms of AI benefits, like a bit more regarding life sciences in particular?
Yeah. So, you know, just focusing on life sciences, I think AI is going to be helped with more automation than anything else. So progressing things from, you know, person to person during handoff. So having, you know, a agent to be able to say, hey, this project needs to go to desktop publishing, rather than somebody going into an FTP site, downloading the files, getting an email drafted up and sending it off to another team, is using AI in a way that you can create kind of prompts to say, after this project is this, you know, area, then it could be launched to the next team and have kind of that authentic, you know, AI agent help support. Because if you think to yourself, when you have to do, you know, 57 different handoffs, to various different teams, having that automation process really saves you time and really gets things out much faster.
It's unbelievable. We were doing all this manually before, isn't it? If you think about it.
Oh, gosh. You know,
I don't know. Working 2 years ago looked so different, like, to what it is today.
It's funny. You know, earlier in my career, I started off and I was in eTMF management. So that's trial master file management. I had to do all the scanning, coding, and indexing of files. So when you think about a trial master file, there's about $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 documents that are being uploaded into your system, and it's all coming from paper. So just imagine when you had to actually code and index them. It's a lot. So having, you know, AI part of the process now that it can detect that this file should be in this, you know, folder helps out the human so much. And I think AI, it's not scary. I think it's something that's more automation. And it's also interesting, the word AI to me, a lot of people think it's just machine translation. And I'm like, no, machine translation's been around for a very long time. You know, the use of translation memories has been around for ages. And I said, you know, this is all part of AI kind of earlier than what we are discussing now with the ChatGPTs and the Gemini Pros and everything else.
Yeah, that's true. Why do proof of concepts fail or succeed, to your opinion? What's the main reason?
Yeah, so, you know, POCs are really important, and it's something that when somebody comes to me and says, hey, we want to try something different, but then they start giving you all the information saying, well, we want to do it on dummy files. These files have been already completed before. We want to compare this to these documents. And I always tell them, no, I said, you need to find a real life case pilot for a real environment project, because you're only going to figure out how to do it in those real elements. So, you know, what I always recommend to sponsors, find a low-risk study, you know, not that many languages. So don't say, hey, I want to do a pilot on a very large global study and see how it goes. You're going to have a lot of pushback. Also, make sure when you're doing the pilot is to have a backup plan. So do things in parallel, just to ensure if the pilot itself did not go successful, you still have the backup just in case, as kind of that protection for your studies. So I think the biggest thing is just make sure that you do plan. Sometimes planning is a little too much. So just kind of rip off the band-aid and say, hey, this is a project that's going to be, let's use this as real environment. We will have the same turnaround times needed. We're not going to pad the times or anything along those lines. And then once you're completed, see what the outcome is. What was the lessons learned? Because every pilot, there is going to be a lessons learned. How we can improve this the next time, how we should change this, you know, for future iterations. But people shouldn't be scared of pilots and, you know, proof of concepts.
That was really interesting. Thank you. What do you think needs to happen for the life sciences industry to modernize and modernize responsibly, and build this long-term confidence in AI, maybe, as it's such a, you know, regulated space?
I think the biggest thing is this. It's technology is crucial. And not to say the pharmaceutical industry is behind the curve. They are always out there creating and being able to push out really groundbreaking drugs and, you know, things along those lines. But when it comes to technology itself in life sciences, it's been very conservative. So that is also an issue. If you think about, you know, the pharmaceutical industry, they are technology-wise 5 years behind. Now, since AI has been kind of introduced, you know, with the launch of ChatGPT, they're trying to play, you know, catch up. They're super excited. I think all senior leadership teams within pharma companies now are like, we need to get ahead. This is like going to be our savior. Tech. And I think the biggest thing is this, is get the foundation down correct. You know, make sure whatever you're doing, you have pilots, it's documented, because the challenge is there's going to be scrutiny 5 years from now to say, well, how did you come up with this decision? So if you're able to say, we done it very controlled, here's the documentation, everyone's going to be happy. The pharma company would be happy. The health authorities will be happy. There's a paper trail. You could be audited the right way and just show, hey, we did this, you know, thoughtfully. Mm-hmm. It works.
And to be honest, we're all learning with AI. Who can say they know exactly how it's going to evolve in the next 5 years? I'm not quite sure. You know, we're still...
There's so many different use cases. Like, there's, you know, in the industry, I think a lot of people think AI is just focused on machine translation. And that's not the case. I think AI helps with a lot of, you know, decision making, you know, automation. Because, you know, what I do on a daily basis in our LV team, you know, we're dealing with highly, you know, scrutinized content, you know, patient material. If a mistranslation or comprehension of a patient is misunderstood, that will throw away all the data. You're going to have tons of costs occurred because you're not going to be able to use that data because of, you know, someone not understanding. And it's a huge no-no. But I think, you know, there are bits and bobs that we are able to use now. There's, you know, the Isoqual just came out with their guidance and they have kind of a green zone and a red zone. The green zone is great. Things like the dual forward translation should be done by a machine, but having a post editor. When it comes to cognitive briefing reports, they said, yes, AI can help draft the initial reports, but have a human come in, review, validate. But, you know, the red zone is, you know, cognitive briefing with a patient. We can't replace a patient and get a response with an AI prompt. Yes, that would be great for turnaround times because these projects on average take 4 to 6 weeks just to collect all the patients, do the interviews and everything along those lines. But we're never going to replicate AI with a patient or a clinician to review or things along those lines. So there's a lot of areas that I think, you know, if you asked us 10 years ago, do you think, you know, artificial intelligence could help out with this area or things like this? We would have said absolutely no. And now today we're like, actually, why haven't we thought of this sooner?
I love that red zone, green zone concept. Thank you very much. Maybe do you have one last thing you want to add, like one piece of advice for people in the industry? Something we haven't mentioned?
Yeah, it's. I think the biggest thing is this: sponsors should, you know, not be scared of AI. I think, you know, there is a lot of conversations happening right now, a lot of hype around it. But once you get to the pilot conversation, that's where everything goes quiet. So I think, you know, for the industry to change, people do need to take calculated risk. So, you know, the great thing is we partner with a lot of great clients here at RWS, and a lot are willing to do a journey with us right now in piloting different ways of doing things. So I think, you know, my biggest recommendation, we can't make change until people try and try to change the health authorities' minds when we are submitting. My biggest recommendation is, you know, when you are submitting, have the conversations early with the health authorities, FDA, and say, we're doing something differently. This is what we're doing. Kind of create that story, show the documentation. So it is more supportive when you do submit rather than just saying, hey, we tried AI for once. Hope this goes through after your findings or review. So I think ultimately it's just sponsors should be more excited about it. I think, you know, when you look at industries outside of mine, and AI is being used, deployed, it's going at a rapid pace. Life science industry is a little behind right now. It is catching up, but they should really try and, you know, do small containment pilots just to see how things go, because they can't wait around for somebody else to do it, because everyone else is saying, well, who has done this yet? And it's like, not many, but we all have to do it at one point. You shouldn't have to wait for somebody else to do it exactly before you do it.
Yeah, of course. What does cultural intelligence mean to you in the life sciences space? Like, short answer.
So for me, you know, it could mean various different things, but, you know, what I want to focus on life sciences, you know, it's more of that human in the loop element. I think ultimately at the end of the day, cultural intelligence, what we do on a daily basis, whatever what workflow it's going through, anything along those lines, you need to ensure whatever you're translating is being understood by that person in that country, culturally relevant, because as we're all aware, English does not translate well. And having that human loop element to ensure that it is, you know, conveying the right message and the meaning, especially in the life sciences, you're dealing with patients. And these are individuals that are either signing up for clinical studies, reading, you know, drug materials that are being provided, that's, you know, prescribed to them. And, you know, also just ensuring that they have a good understanding of what they're signing up for. Because as we all know, when you go to a doctor's appointment, things like that, and you get told, oh, you have to take this medication, you're trying to read some of that information, you think, oh boy, this is confusing. But then you speak to a GP and they make it sound so easy. So I think, you know, whoever is in the pharma industry, you know, when you're building content, know this is ultimately going to an individual and you want to make sure that it's understood. So the cultural intelligence with the mix of AI and human in the loop, you know, is ensuring that, you know, the reading level is correct, that it's relevant to the market, and such, just because if it's not, not many people are going to be trustworthy of either joining a trial or taking the medication, because if you have a bad experience, you tend not to go back.
Yeah. And yeah, we're talking about health at the end of the day. It's also like a very stressful side of things, you know. Some people are might feel a bit, you know, stressed about it, so it's important to meet, you know, to meet them where they are, because it's not an easy topic in general, you know. So yeah, thank you Dan for being here, thank you for answering all our questions. It was an honor to have you here, and yeah, see you next time for the next episode, really.
And thank you so much for having me today.